Hey, Pete, did you check the horses?
Yeah, I checked them. They're fine.
Dismounting, Pete sat down on a rock, pulled up a long piece of grass, and began sucking on the root.
Tell me, Johnny, just how much longer do you plan to keep this up?
How much longer do I plan on keeping what up?
You know what I'm talking about. This business of going into town every night and killing someone. We ain't gonna get away with this forever, you know.
We're doing fine so far, Pete.
That's 'cause we ain't been seen. But you've been leaving them letters, telling the whole world we's the ones done it. That means we're gonna hang for sure if we ever get caught.
What the hell, Pete? Do you think we won't hang now if we get caught? We killed a banker, remember?
Another thing, I probably got me more money in my saddlebag now than I've ever had at one time in my whole life. What's the good of having all that money if I can't spend none of it?
What would you spend it on if you was in town?
I don't know. Whiskey, maybe? And a whore? Yeah, I'd get me a whore, that's for sure.
Pete looked at the spitted rabbit that was cooking over the fire.
And a decent dinner, too.
Think about it, Pete. If you don't lose your patience, if you just stick around and see this thing through to the end, you won't be spending it on one whore. Hell, you can buy yourself an entire whorehouse.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it like that, but that's right, ain't it? I could buy myself a whorehouse and just have anyone I wanted any time I wanted.
Oh, yeah. You could buy your own restaurant, too, if you wanted one.
Yeah, well, now, buying a restaurant might not be a bad idea, because I'm sure as hell getting tired of eating squirrel and rabbit and the like.
Gabe leaned over the fire and stuck the point of his knife into the roasting rabbit.
This here looks about done.
Rabbit is a hell of a breakfast for a rich man to be eating now, ain't it? I'm on a steak.
Hey, Pete. If you don't want your share of rabbit, I'll eat it.
I didn't say I wasn't going to eat it. I just implied I was tired of it. And I was just wondering why we're doing all this for Johnny's brother when we should be planning to hit the bank again.
That's exactly what we're doing. There ain't none of this about my brother.
Johnny carved off a piece of rabbit.
What do you mean there ain't none of this about your brother? It's all about your brother.
No, it ain't. Damn, ow, shit, that meat's hot.
It's about the same thing it's always been about. It's about robbing the bank. You see, the thing is, we keep hitting them about my brother. Pretty soon, they're gonna forget all about the bank. So even though we've robbed it before, we'll be able to walk in there a second time just as pretty as you please. There won't be nobody in that town expecting us to come back.
The topics of conversation in the nearly deserted Gold Strike Saloon this morning were Tui Keith and Troy Garrison.
I don't know if any of you gentlemen remember the time that cowboy from the Double X dropped a quarter into the spittoon and told Tui he could have it if he would stick his hand down in the spittoon and get it out.
Yeah, at first, I was pissed off at the cowboy for doing something like that. I started to say something, too, but Tui just held up his hand as if telling me to wait. Then he emptied the spittoon and cleaned it out before he got the quarter back.
Yes, the cowboy got real mad and tried to take his quarter back. He said Tui didn't do what he was supposed to do.
That's when you told the cowboy you was a lawyer, and that, in your opinion, Tui had fulfilled his end of the contract.
The cowboy just looked real strange and said, "What contract?" And then you told him. What was it exactly that you told him?
I simply told him that his offer constituted a verbal contract, enforceable in any court in the land, and that his contract stated only that Tui was to stick his hand down into the spittoon. It said nothing about sticking his hand into the mess.
The cowboy looked like he'd been shot. I do believe it was his last quarter.
I'm sure it was. He didn't spend another dime in here that night.
Troy Garrison was a good man, too.
Yeah, I didn't know Mr. Garrison that well.
I knew him really well. We worked together.
Oh, yeah. I knew he worked down at the Rolling Mill, but I don't know that I ever saw him come in here.
No, and you wouldn't. Garrison was a teetotaler.
Oh, well, that would explain it, I reckon.
He was from Missouri. His father was a drunk. Used to beat Garrison up when he was a kid. used to beat up his mother, too. Then one day, after his father half-killed his mother, Troy picked up a shotgun and blew his father away.
Ah, damn! I never knew that. I mean, I saw him every day, and I never knew that.
No, nobody in town knew it. Mr. Garrison came to me a couple of years ago and said he wanted to get it off his chest. He asked me if I thought he should go back to Missouri and confess.
Well, what'd you tell him?
I told him to just leave it be, and that if anything ever came of it, I would defend him pro bono.
Pro bono? What's that mean?
It means I would defend him for free.
How old was Garrison when he did that?
I think he told me he was 15.
That's a hell of a burden for a 15-year-old to have to carry around with him.
Yes, it is. He left home immediately after it happened, then started wandering around until he wound up here. He never went home again.
Hell of a way for him to wind up, face down in the alley like that.
At least he wasn't married. It would have been even more tragic if he left a widow behind.
Well, that's true. Neither one of them was married.
At noon, Sheriff Gibson stuck his head in through the saloon door.
Falcon, Miss Coyle, I'll take you two to lunch now.
We could eat here.
Now, why would you want to eat saloon food when you could eat Ms. Martin's food?
Sheriff, sounds to me like Mrs. Martin has offered to feed you as well.
Me and my deputy. Let's go.
Where's Mitchum?
He's still at the bank. Edwards is with him. We'll stop by and pick him up on the way down to Ms. Martin's boarding house.
Mitchum was smiling broadly when Falcon and the others went into the bank.
I have great news. The money that was stolen has been replaced.
Replaced? How?
Our bank belongs to a mutual cooperative with several other banks. We have an insurance policy in effect that can replace money lost in a robbery. I'm proud to say that not one depositor lost money as a result of the robbery.
Well, the citizens of the town will be happy to hear that. Oh, and I see you have someone new working with you.
Yes, this is Abner Brookfield. He arrived from Denver this morning. He is well experienced in the banking profession and will assume the job of teller.
Good. Then you've got someone you can leave in charge while we all go to lunch.
Yes, he can handle the position quite well. Mr. Brookfield, I will be back within the hour.
Yes, sir, Mr. Mitchum.
Leaving the bank, the five started toward the Martin house. They were met halfway there by young Gordon, who came running up to meet them. Falcon greeted him with a smile.
Well, there he is. Gordon Martin, the fastest runner in Albany County.
Hello, Mr. McAllister. Sheriff, Miss Coyle. Mom sent me to the store to buy a can of peaches. Guess what? We're having fried peach pies for supper. Do you like fried peach pies?
Well, who doesn't like fried peach pies?
Oh, they're my favorite thing.
Suddenly, eight mounted horsemen galloped down the middle of the street. They showed no sign to stop.
What in the world's going on? Is that a bunch of drunken cowboys?
I'll tell them to slow down, Sheriff.
Edward started toward the middle of the street, signaled.
Deputy, no! It's Johnny Purvis!
Deputy Edwards went down. Falcon and the sheriff both started shooting back. Falcon got one, and the sheriff got another. But at that moment, a freight wagon was rumbling into town. Johnny managed to maneuver his men behind it. Using the wagon for cover, the six remaining riders were able to dart up between two buildings, getting them out of the line of fire. Across the railroad track, and put the depot between them and the town, they rode away across the prairie. Putting his gun away, Falcon turned back toward the others. That was when he saw that both Mitchum and Gordon were down.
Gordon!
Did you get any of them?
Yeah. So did the sheriff.
That's good. Tell Mom, save me a piece of fried peach pie.
Gordon. Gordon! Gordon!
From the Sentinel. More violence plagues our city. Mounted gunmen ride through city. Four of the assailants are killed. Edwards and Mitchum gunned down. Young Gordon Martin among the dead. By James Hayford, publisher. The battlefields of the U.S. cavalry, engaged in mortal combat with the Indians, hold no sway over the streets of Laramie. Indeed, of late, we could compete with some of the great battles of the War of Rebellion so recently fought. Laramie now has the dubious distinction of having come to the notice of the great metropolises of the East. where such cities as Chicago, St. Louis, Philadelphia, and New York fill their pages with stories of the violence taking place in our streets. One might think there is pride in such recognition, but that is not the case, for our notoriety comes from our bloody history of recent days. On Wednesday of this week, 8 riders, among them one Johnny Purvis, bank robber and brother of a prisoner about to face trial, rode into town. They sprayed the town with deadly gunfire, killing Deputy Edwards and Banker Mitchum. They also killed young Gordon Martin, son of the widow Martin, who runs a boarding house on the west end of town. Our readers may remember young Gordon as the lad who won the foot race in the series of athletic events so recently held. That so young and vibrant a life could be so cruelly cut down accrues to the shame of us all. Readers may also remember from the last edition of the Sentinel that 2 of our citizens, Troy Garrison and Tui Keith, were found murdered, with notes affixed, demanding the release of the bank robber now in custody. It is believed that those who so brazenly assaulted our town are the self-same people who came in the night to murder the 2 aforementioned souls. Funerals for the 3 who fell before the villains' guns will be held on Thursday of this week. Because of the public sympathy for the bereaved, it is believed that the aggregate of these funerals may be the largest in Laramie's history, if not indeed in the entire history of Wyoming.
Because there was only one hearse, the funerals of Edwards, Mitchum, and Gordon were carried out at 3 different times. Gordon's funeral was the last, and perhaps because he was the youngest, it was the largest. The population of Laramie was 2,000 people, and nearly all lined the street to watch the hearse drive by, Gordon's glossy black coffin clearly visible through the glass sides of the hearse. Francis, dressed in black with a long black veil, rode in an open carriage behind the hearse. Her brother-in-law, Cody, was riding with her, his arm around her shoulders. As the hearse passed by, the spectators moved out into the street to follow the ever-growing cortege to the cemetery. There, they stood by as the Reverend E.D. Owen conducted the funeral.
The reading from the 61st Psalm. I will abide in thy tabernacle forever. I will trust in the covert of thy wings. For thou, O God, hast heard my vows. Thou hast given me the heritage of those that fear thy name. Thou wilt prolong the king's life, and his years as many generations. He shall abide before God forever. O, prepare mercy and truth which may preserve him.
Francis stepped forward and sprinkled a handful of dirt on top of the coffin. Then the coffin was lowered into the ground.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, we commit the body of thy servant, Gordon O'Neill Martin, in the sure and certain hope of his resurrection and life eternal in the blessed arms of our Lord. Amen.
Sheriff Gibson stepped over to Francis as the funeral concluded.
Miss Martin, I can't begin to express my condolences to you. Gordon was a fine, fine boy. No, he wasn't a boy. He was a fine young man.
Thank you, Sheriff Gibson.
If there's anything I can do...
I'm fine, thank you.
Nodding, Gibson left the cemetery. He hurried down to the depot, reaching there even as he heard the afternoon train arrive. The train sat there for several seconds before the first passenger disembarked.
Judge Blair, over here.
Judge Blair was a tall, thin man, clean-shaven, and with silver hair. Answering Gibson's summons, he came over to shake the sheriff's hand.
Did you have a good trip?
I came 40 miles in but 2 hours. How could it not be good?
40 miles in 2 hours? We do live in marvelous times.
Indeed. So, Sheriff Gibson... You have a place for me to stay? I've been led to believe that every room in the hotel is booked up.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. The hotel is booked. But I've made arrangements for you, if you don't mind sleeping in a room above the saloon.
Well, that depends. Will I be sharing the room with one of the soiled doves?
I'm afraid not, Your Honor. I'll get your grip.
As Sheriff Gibson and Judge Blair walked down the sidewalk toward the gold strike, The judge noticed that many of the buildings were draped with black bunting.
What's all the bunting for?
Well, Judge, maybe you haven't heard, but there have been 11 people killed here in the last 3 weeks.
11? My. I knew you had experienced some difficulty here. I had no idea that 11 had been killed. What about the fella I'm to try? Is he charged with the murders?
Just one of the murders, Your Honor. Though his brother has been trying to force us to release him, and he's responsible for at least 5 more.
Well, you can hang a man for 1 killing, or for 5. Either way, he's dead.
Now, how soon do you intend to start the trial?
I take it that the defendant is not represented by counsel?
No, Your Honor.
I'll need to meet with all the lawyers in town so I can choose both the defense and the prosecuting attorney. And they'll need a few days to get prepared for the case. We'll have the trial as soon as we can get it all arranged.
It can't be too soon to suit me.
The number of killings in and around Laramie had, as Hayford reported in his newspaper, drawn national attention, and reporters from dozens of newspapers had come to Laramie to cover the trial. Because of the shortage of hotel rooms, they had to be put up in various places around town, James Hayford making most of the arrangements for them. 4 of the reporters were staying with Frances Martin, 2 of them sharing her room and 2 sleeping on cots in the parlor. Frances moved again into Gordon's room. Falcon stepped into the kitchen as Frances was preparing supper.
Frances, are you sure you want to do this?
Do what?
Have this many people stay in your house. I would think you might want some time alone. In fact, I'm willing to move out myself if you want me to. Of course, I'd pay the full amount we agreed upon.
No, don't do that. I'm glad you're here. The others, too. If I couldn't stay busy, all I would do is sit around all day and cry.
I understand. My wife has been dead for many years now, but sometimes it's almost as if I can hear her laughter in the wind. And at night, there are times when I can still feel her warm body next to mine.
How did you get through it, Falcon? How do you get rid of the pain? Where did you go for help?
Falcon put his hand gently on Francis' shoulder.
You'll learn, Francis, that you can't go anywhere for help. It's a journey you must take alone. But in these few days I've been here, I've come to know you. And I know you have the strength to get through this.
I don't want to be strong.
Francis leaned against Falcon and put her head on his chest. After a moment or two, she pulled away from him and wiped her nose with the handkerchief she held clutched in her hand.
I know you say that no one can help, but I do thank you for being here.
One of the reporters stuck his head into the kitchen.
Excuse me, madam, but I was wondering if, that is, we were wondering if you had any coffee prepared. We could drink it as we await our dinner.
Go on back and sit down. I'll bring you some coffee.
Thank you. That's very nice of you.
Falcon helped Frances serve dinner, then held the chair for her before sitting down himself. The reporters had been discussing the local story, as well as several other events.
McAllister. I seem to know that name.
It's a fairly common name.
Wait. I know what it is. There's an acting team in the New York Theater, quite well known they are. Andrew and Rosanna McAllister. I believe, in fact, I am sure that they are husband and wife.
They're brother and sister.
Really? And just how would someone like you know that?
Because they're my brother and sister.
You don't say.
Yep. You don't think I would brag about having relatives in New York, do you?
Mr. Calder, I can't believe you don't know who Mr. McAllister is.
The speaker, Stanley Morgan, was from the Denver newspaper.
Good heavens. You aren't going to tell me that this big galoot is an actor as well.
Hardly. But he is one of the best-known pistoleros in the West. Some say he's better than Wild Bill Hickok ever was. That he's superior to Wyatt Earp or Clay Allison or Temple Houston.
Oh, my. Are you what they call a gunfighter? Have you ever killed anyone, Mr. McAllister?
For God's sake, Calder. Didn't you do any research at all before you left New York?
Yes, Mr. Calder. I've killed.
How many?
I don't think that's anything you need to know.
It's a morbid question, I admit, and I apologize for asking. It's just that before I came out here, I did a story about the phantom sharpshooter of Devil's Den. so I have such things on my mind. I'm sure that's why my editor sent me here to cover the many shootings that have taken place.
Who's the phantom sharpshooter of Devil's Den?
Well, that's just it. Nobody really knows, actually. Oh, we know his name, and we know he's a New Yorker. But that's all we know about him. He seems to have just disappeared after the war, and all efforts to find him have proven fruitless.
What's his name?
His name is Fitzpatrick O'Neill. He's an Irishman.
What did you find out about O'Neill?
Practically nothing. Except for the remarkable job of shooting he did during the Battle of Gettysburg. It is said that he killed 23 rebels in a single afternoon, every victim taken with a single shot from a distance of over 300 yards.
23 in a single afternoon? Oof. I think that would make even our most productive gunman take notice. What do you think, Mr. McAllister?
I think Mr. O'Neill probably has some ghosts to deal with.
Gentlemen, I hate to interrupt this spirited conversation, but I'm going to have to clear the table so I can get the dishes washed for breakfast in the morning.
A most reasonable request, madam. I must write my first report anyway. I'll work on it tonight. Good night, gentlemen.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, I'm for bed myself. Good night, all.
Good night.
Good night.
Francis went into the kitchen to heat water on the stove. Falcon joined her.
May I help you, Francis?
No need. I can do it myself.
I didn't ask if you needed me to help. I was asking your permission to let me help.
Well, of course you can help me if you want to.
I want to.
Falcon picked up several of the plates from the dining room and carried them into the kitchen.
I wash, you dry.
Francis poured the heated water into one dishpan to which she added soap. Another pan beside it held clear water for rinsing.
Can you believe there are so many reporters here?
We seem to have drawn them.
Done redding up the dishes, Falcon took the first plate to dry.
Where do I put this?
Just stack them on the sideboard. I'll be using them for breakfast.
The reporter from New York is quite a talkative fella.
He's rather typical of New Yorkers, though.
Have you met many New Yorkers?
I was born and raised in New York City.
You were? I didn't know that.
Given your apparent disdain for New York, I thought it best not to tell you.
I have no disdain for New York. You heard me tell the reporter that my brother and sister are there. Besides, I fought against some New York regiments during the war. I know what good men they were.
You fought for the South?
Yeah.
I was for the North.
I figured as much. I had a brother who fought for the North.
Such is the tragedy. I guess there were a lot of families divided by the war.
What brought you to the West?
I got married after the war. My husband was a railroad man, and he was excited by the prospect of being able to cross this entire country by train. He signed on with the Union Pacific, and we wound up out here.
You said he was killed in a railroad accident?
Yes. A trestle across Dead Horse Gulch gave way, and his engine fell about 200 feet.
I'm sorry.
A tear slid down Francis's cheek.
At least he's with Gordon now.
From the pen of Lee Calder. Special to the New York Standard, Laramie, Wyoming Territory. The first thing one notices when stepping down from the train in Laramie is that the entire city is blanketed in a pall of smoke. The smoke emanates from the rolling mill, a huge, exceedingly ugly edifice which houses the machinery for making steel rails. The people of Laramie are quite proud of this factory, as it employs well over 100 of their fellow citizens. The next thing one notices is the horrible odor that permeates the entire town. For the most part, this is due to the condition of the streets, filled as they are with the droppings from the horses, mules, and draft oxen that ply their ways in pursuit of commerce. It is also due to the fact that the city has no sanitary department to speak of, and thus refuse of all description is allowed to collect at various points around the town. But for all this, Laramie is now the center of attention for much of the nation. It has achieved this level of prominence from the fact that, within the last 3 weeks, 9 men have been shot down in the streets. 2 more men have died by the piteous method of having had their throats cut. And who is responsible for all this violence? If the prosecutor and the people of the town are to have their way, the responsibility will fall upon the head, or perhaps I should say the neck, of a man named Carney. I am sorry, dear readers, that I cannot give you more of a name than that. From the moment of his capture, Connie has refused to disclose his entire name, though it is believed that his name might be Carney Purvis. This belief is fostered by the fact that the leader of the violent gang to which Carney belonged is Johnny Purvis. Purvis has instigated a series of murders, and in a bit of vainglory has left notes pinned to the bodies of his victims in which he demands the release of his brother, Carney. Of course, one could make the case that he is using the term brother in the same way that various gangs of ruffians have referred to themselves as a brotherhood, thus including all who belong as their brother. But most believe that in this case, Carney really is the biological brother of Johnny Purvis. The trial of Carney Purvis begins at 1 o'clock on the 5th instant, and your intrepid reporter will be present from the fall of the judge's gavel until the end of the trial. Although seats in the courthouse are at a premium, some have been set aside for the many reporters present, and by my pen, you, my dear reader, shall be able to follow the entire event word by word.
The Albany County Courthouse was a substantial two-story brick building with long, narrow, arched windows and doors. It was surrounded by poplar trees that were in full foliage, thus providing some shade for the building. Even before the trial started, staff workers had gone about with long, hooked poles, drawing the windows down from the top and lifting them up from the bottom, thus providing cross ventilation, which, with the shade of the trees, made the courtroom fairly pleasant. The door to the courtroom was opened at 12:30, one half hour before the trial was to begin. Sheriff Gibson and two of his deputies stood at the door, taking the guns from all who entered.
The hell you mean I can't come in here wearing my gun? I wear my gun everywhere I go!
And you can still wear it everywhere else you go. You just can't wear it in this courtroom.
The cowboy wasn't the only one to complain, but like the cowboy, everyone who asked to shed their guns did so.
Falcon, I hate to ask you to get shed of your gun. I asked Judge Blair if I could appoint you a temporary deputy, but because you're a witness, he said it wouldn't be proper.
I understand.
Falcon removed his pistol and handed it handle first to the sheriff.
Do you have a holdout gun?
Falcon hesitated for a moment, then pulled the double-barreled Derringer from his boot and handed it over as well.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. You're just doing your duty, Sheriff.
Falcon went inside the courthouse to take a seat. Because he was a witness, a seat was reserved for him in the front row, where he sat next to Kathleen.
Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes. This court in and for the County of Albany is now in session, the Honorable Judge Jacob Blair presiding. God bless the United States of America, the territory of Wyoming, and this honorable court. All rise.
The gallery of the court was packed with every seat occupied. Wearing a black robe, Judge Blair entered the courtroom from a door in front, stood behind the bench for a moment, then sat down.
Be seated. What is the purpose of this court?
Your Honor, there comes before this honorable court one Carney, who is charged with bank robbery and for the murder of Gene Frazier.
Carney, is that the first name or the last name?
We don't know, Your Honor. The only name he would give us is Carney.
Very well. Let the record reflect that the man we are trying, and the man we may ultimately hang, shall be known only as Carney.
You think my brother's gonna let you hang me? I can tell you right now, he ain't gonna allow it.
Mr. Carney, one more outburst from you and I will have you bound and gagged. You understand that? Do you understand that, sir?
Yeah.
You mean yes, Your Honor, do you not? You mean yes, Your Honor, do you not? Sheriff, get manacles and a gag.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may stand down, Sheriff. Counsel for the defense, if you do not keep your client in check, I will hold you in contempt. You understand that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Now, will the counsel for defense publish his name and qualifications?
The lawyer sitting beside Carney stood.
I am counsel for the defense, Your Honor, appointed by the court. My name is Anthony Norton, duly authorized by the Bar of Wyoming to practice law.
Very good. Is prosecution present?
I have been appointed by the county prosecutor to act as prosecutor, Your Honor. I am Bill Nye.
Mr. Nye, I trust that you will not, in the middle of this trial, write a letter to the President of the United States tendering your resignation.
I will see the case through, Your Honor.
Well, aren't we the lucky ones? All right, Mr. Prosecutor, I invite you to make your case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As Nye walked over to begin his presentation to the jury, Falcon noticed that the jury was composed of men and women. For a moment, it startled him. Then he remembered having read that Wyoming was the only state or territory in the nation that allowed women to vote as well as serve on a jury. Nye bowed to the four women who sat together. They gravely nodded their heads back to him.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, there are in this city today women who have been deprived of their husbands, children deprived of their fathers, and even a grieving mother deprived of her child.
I object, Your Honor.
Your objection to my opening statement?
Mr. Norton, to what are you objecting?
I'm objecting to counsel's mention of the number of widows and fatherless children in Laramie.
Are you making the claim that the statement is false?
Nye pointed to the row of newspaper journalists who were busy taking notes.
Surely you don't think newspaper men came from all over the country just to cover the trial of your client? Your objection is denied.
You are out of order, Mr. Nye. I will rule on the objection.
I was just trying to help out, Your Honor.
Objection denied.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Turning to the jury, Nye continued his opening remarks, speaking for another 5 minutes. When it was the plaintiff's turn, Norton didn't approach the jury, but spoke from his position behind the defendant's table.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, despite the prosecutor's brazen attempt to suggest that my client was in some way responsible for the fact that there are many widows and fatherless children in Laramie now, I hope you realize that he is being tried for one murder and one murder alone. And I intend to present evidence that will introduce doubt as to whether Mr. Carney was personally responsible for the death of Mr. Frazier.
Norton held up his finger for a long moment, as if asking the jury to focus on his next statement.
And I remind you that the law requires you to be satisfied, beyond the shadow of a doubt, as to the guilt of a person before you can find him guilty. If you cannot find him guilty, beyond the shadow of a doubt, you must acquit. Thank you.
Prosecution may call the first witness.
Prosecution calls Mr. Falcon McAllister to the stand.
Falcon walked to the front of the court, raised his right hand, and was sworn in as a witness.
Mr. McAllister, would you please tell the court in your own words what happened on Thursday, July 17th of the current year?
I'd come into the bank with Miss Kathleen Coyle. The bank was empty, except for the bank owner, Mr. Frazier, and the bank teller, Mr. Mitchum. They were standing at the front window, looking at the fire.
And what fire would that be?
The feed store had been set on fire by the bank robbers in order to create a diversion.
Objection, Your Honor. The witness has made a conclusion based on facts, not in evidence. We don't know that the bank robbers started the fire.
Sustained.
Mr. McAllister, how do you know that the bank robbers started the fire?
Purvis told us he started the fire.
Objection, Your Honor. Hearsay.
Sustained. The jury will disregard the comment referring to who started the fire. Abandon this particular line of questioning, Mr. Nye.
Yes, Your Honor. Go ahead with your narrative, Mr. McAllister.
We, that is Miss Coyle and I, were getting ready to conduct our business when six masked men came into the bank.
Was Carney one of the six?
He was.
Objection, Your Honor. If the men were masked, how can he be sure Carney was one of them?
That's a good question, Your Honor. May I ask that of my witness?
By all means, Mr. Nye.
Mr. McAllister, if the men were masked, how do you know that one of them was Carney?
Well, for one thing, look at him. You don't see many men as large as he is. And for another, he and Johnny Purvis pulled their masks down while they were in the bank.
So you saw his face during the robbery?
I did.
Withdraw the objection, Your Honor.
Good. That saves me the trouble of having to overrule it.
Falcon continued with his narrative, describing the consternation of the robbers when they learned that the bank didn't have as much money as they thought it should have. He concluded his testimony with the shooting of Gene Frazier.
Mr. McAllister, did you see Carney shoot Gene Frazier?
Yep.
Thank you. Your witness, Counselor.
Norton approached the witness.
Mr. McAllister, the bank robbery took place on what day?
The 17th of July.
Is that the first time you ever saw Mr. Carney?
No.
So, you had seen him before?
Yeah.
Where did you see him?
In the Gold Strike Saloon.
And what was the occasion of that meeting?
I beg your pardon?
The meeting that you and Mr. Carney had in the Gold Strike prior to the bank robbery. Would you say that the meeting was convivial?
No, I wouldn't say it was friendly.
In fact, didn't you and Mr. Carney have an altercation? And didn't he give you a black eye?
Your Honor, I object. Whether or not Mr. McAllister saw Carney before the bank robbery is irrelevant.
I can establish relevancy, Your Honor.
Then by all means, Counselor, please do so.
It calls into question this witness's objectivity. After all, if he had his eye blackened by my client in an episode of fisticuffs, he might be looking for some way of extracting revenge.
You are an idiot, Mr. Norton.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Do you have any idea who Falcon McAllister is?
I seem to have heard the name.
You seem to have heard the name. Well, let me tell you, Mr. Norton, Falcon McAllister has earned a reputation for honesty and fair play. Based upon what I know about the man, I can say that your worries as to whether or not he is testifying in some manner to seek revenge against Carney is without foundation. The objection is sustained. Go to another line of questioning.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. McAllister, you said that you saw my client shoot Mr. Frazier.
Yes.
Did he and he alone shoot Mr. Frazier?
Nope.
No? What do you mean, no? I believe you just stated that you saw him shoot Frazier. Now you say he didn't?
The question you asked was, did he and he alone shoot Frazier? The answer is no. All of them were shooting at Mr. Frazier.
All of them were shooting at Mr. Frazier.
Norton walked back to his table and picked up a piece of paper.
Mr. McAllister, I have here the coroner's report. According to the coroner, Mr. Frazier suffered 4 bullet wounds. I believe you said there were 6 men in the bank, and all 6 were shooting?
Yeah.
All 6 were shooting, yet only 4 bullets hit Mr. Frazier. That means at least 2 of the shooters missed, doesn't it? And in fact, isn't it possible that all but 1 may have missed?
Well, it's possible, I suppose.
What is impossible is that all 6 shooters hit him.
Well, obviously not all 6 shooters hit him.
Obviously. All right. For the sake of argument, let us say that 4 of the shooters hit him. 1 bullet struck Mr. Frazier in the lung, and according to the coroner, would probably have proven to be fatal. Another struck him in the abdomen, which may have been fatal. A 3rd struck him in the arm and would not have been fatal. A 4th struck him in the forehead, and according to the coroner, it was this shot that killed him. Mr. McAllister, did Mr. Carney fire the shot that hit Mr. Frazier in the head?
I don't know.
No, of course. There is no way you could know that, is there? Did he fire the shot that hit him in the lung?
I don't know.
Did he fire the shot that hit Mr. Frazier in the abdomen?
I don't know.
Did Mr. Carney fire the shot that hit Mr. Frazier in the arm?
I don't know.
Indeed, sir. The truth is, you can't even testify as to whether or not the bullet my client fired hit Mr. Frazier at all, can you?
No.
Let me ask you this, Mr. McAllister. Given the testimony we have just heard, if you were sitting in the jury, could you say, without a shadow of a doubt, that Mr. Carney killed Mr. Frazier?
Objection, Your Honor. Calls for conclusion.
Sustained. You do not need to answer that, Mr. McAllister. And the jury is instructed to draw no inference from the question.
Your Honor, I have no further questions of this witness.
Redirect.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. McAllister, can you state from observable fact that Carney was shooting?
Oh, yeah, he was shooting.
I'm sure the jury knows, and if they do not know, I will remind them during my summation that in the commission of a felony, all participants are equally guilty.
Nye rose and walked over to the exhibit table. He picked up the coroner's report.
So, you see, it doesn't matter which one of these bullets came from Carney's gun, or, indeed, if any of them came from his gun.
Nye sat down.
Witness is excused.
Falcon took his seat beside Kathleen.
I sure hope you do better than I did.
Kathleen didn't meet his gaze.
Prosecution calls Miss Kathleen Coyle.
After being sworn in, Kathleen took her seat. At the beginning, her testimony was very much like Falcon's. She told of going to the bank to make a deposit for the gold strike. She also told of seeing the fire and seeing Frazier and Mitchum standing by the window watching the fire.
And then what happened, Miss Coyle?
Well, like Mr. McAllister said, six masked men came into the bank.
Was Mr. Carney one of the six?
Yes.
And you know this because at one point during the robbery, he pulled his mask down.
Yes.
Did you see Mr. Frazier get killed?
Yes.
How was he killed?
Kathleen was quiet for a long moment, and Nye, who had looked toward the jury to gauge their reaction to her testimony, turned back toward her when he realized that she had gone a long time without answering the question.
Miss Coyle, can you tell us what happened?
I don't know. It all happened so fast. It was all so confusing with everyone shooting. I mean, I know it was an accident and he was only trying to help, but I think it is entirely possible that Mr. Frazier was killed by a bullet from Mr. McAllister's gun.
Order! Order! Order in the court!
From that moment on, the proceedings became predictable. No more surprises were forthcoming. When the jury was dismissed for deliberation, Falcon turned to Kathleen.
Kathleen, how could you possibly say that one of my bullets might have killed Frazier? I wasn't even shooting. You know my gun was in the spittoon.
But you were shooting. You killed Jerry Snyder that morning, and you wounded Will.
Yeah, but that was afterward. That took place on the street in... Wait a minute. Who's Will?
The door to the jury deliberation room opened.
Hey! Jury's already coming back in.
What do you mean, coming back? They just left.
Ed Carter, the jury foreman, walked back in. A tall man with dark eyes and a black sweeping mustache was with him. Johnny Purvis was holding a pistol to Carter's head.
Order in the court! Order in the court! I've always wanted to do that. Everybody sit down, now!
How dare you come into my court?
How dare I? Because I'm holding a gun to this man's head, that's how dare I. Now, when I said for everybody to sit down, that meant you too, Judge. You just sit the fuck down right now, or I'll blow this man's head off.
I knew you'd come for me, Johnny.
We're family, Carney. Family always sticks together. Ain't that right, girlie?
Johnny appeared to be addressing Kathleen as he pushed Carter ahead of him. There was another man behind him.
Polk. Give your gun to Carney.
What? What do you mean, give my gun to him? What am I gonna use?
Girlie, get the sheriff's gun and bring it to Polk.
You keep her out of it, Purvis. She doesn't have anything to do with this.
It's all right, Falcon. I'll do it. There have been enough people killed already. I don't want anyone else to get hurt.
Kathleen got up from her seat in the gallery and walked over to Sheriff Gibson to relieve him of his gun.
Be careful with that, Miss Coyle.
Holding the pistol by her thumb and forefinger, Kathleen took it over to Johnny, then held it out toward him. The gallery looked on in fear and nervousness. Johnny shook his head.
No, you bitch, don't give it to me. You take the gun, Polk.
Polk walked over to Kathleen.
Give me that.
He jerked the gun away from her. Falcon pointed to Johnny.
I'm warning you, Purvis. Don't you hurt that girl.
Johnny put his arm around Kathleen and pulled her to him. He kissed her on the cheek, and to Falcon's shocked surprise, Kathleen kissed him back.
Now, tell me, McAllister, just why would me and Carney want to hurt our very own sister?
Your sister?
Yeah! Gurley's our sister. Her real name is Kathleen, but me and Carney's always called her Gurley. Ain't that right, Gurley?
Kathleen said nothing, but she continued to look at Falcon with what looked like an expression of shame and contrition.
Oh, and that business up in Miles City where I broke into her room? We set that up so she could get close to you. And the whole reason she took a job here in the saloon was so she could help set everything up for us to rob the bank. But the joke was on us. Well, we didn't even know nothing about there not being no money there yet. Why, the money didn't get there till today.
You son of a bitch. Are you saying you robbed the bank today?
Yeah. While you folks was all busy with your trial, we was busy robbing the bank. Pretty smart, huh? $111,000 we got. That's not as much as I thought, but you gotta admit that ain't fucking bad. Carney and Gurley, come on. Poke, you keep this fella covered till we get out of here.
Don't worry, I got him.
Poke stepped up behind the frightened Carter and pointed his pistol at his head. Johnny Purvis, Carney, Kathleen, and Poke started to leave. As they passed by Falcon, Sheriff Gibson, who was on the opposite side of the room, suddenly threw the empty chair next to him through the window. Distracted, Poke looked toward the sound. As he did so, Falcon pushed the jury foreman out of the way, then jumped Poke and struggled to get his gun.
Johnny, I've been shot!
Carney looked back toward Kathleen and stopped.
Come on, Carney, let's get out of here.
Gurley's been shot.
I said, let's get out of here.
Johnny shot back into the courtroom, and everyone dove for the floor.
I'll kill the first man that sticks his head out the door.
During this time, the struggle between Falcon and Pope continued. Pope went down, clutching a wound in his stomach. Falcon backed away, the gun now in his hand, and he ran for the front door. Johnny, Carney, and three more who had waited out front were gone, leaving Kathleen and Pope behind.
God damn it!
Falcon ran back into the courthouse. The doctor, who had come to see the trial, was kneeling beside Kathleen. The doctor looked up at Falcon, and though he said nothing, he made a small, barely perceptible shake of his head.
Falcon.
Falcon knelt down beside Kathleen.
I'm sorry. They were my brothers. We had different fathers, but the same mother. Johnny Purvis and Will Carney raised me. I had to do it. All the killing. Poor Mr. Keith and Mr. Garrison. Mr. Mitchum and Gordon. I had no idea they would be doing anything like that. I'm so sorry. I didn't know. Falcon, do you really think I could have made it on the stage in New York?
I'm sure you could have.
That would have really been something. Johnny and Will laughed at me for it. But that would have really been something.
Go after them, Falcon. Don't worry about the cattle. For you, I will get some prime stock and at a good price.
Falcon nodded. He knew and trusted Coors, and if Coors said he'd get prime stock at a good price, Falcon could take that to the bank.
Thanks.
Falcon?
Falcon looked up and saw that the sheriff was holding his guns out to him. Falcon gave the sheriff's pistol back to him, then he took his own Colt and slipped it into his holster. After that, he took the Derringer and pushed it down into the top of his boot.
I know you ain't much for badges, but in front of these witnesses, I'm deputizing you. It'll keep you legal, at least as long as you're in Albany County.
I'm not gonna stop at the county line.
No, I didn't figure you would.
Thank you.
Back in his room at the Borden house, Falcon changed from the black suit and white shirt he had worn during the court case into trail clothes of jeans, long-sleeved shirt, and vest. He put his hat on and tied up his bedroll. Because no one had knocked, Falcon whirled toward the opening door. He saw Francis Martin standing in the doorway. To Falcon's surprise, Francis didn't react in fear to his sudden draw against her. In fact, she stood in the doorway as calmly as if she were carrying on a casual conversation with him. She was also wearing clothes that were nearly identical to what he was wearing. Pants, a long-sleeved shirt, a vest, and a low-crowned black hat. She wasn't wearing a pistol, but she was carrying two rifles.
What are you doing dressed like that?
You're going after Johnny and the others, aren't you?
I am.
So am I.
The hell you are.
I'm going after the men who killed me son.
Francis, look. I know you're a good shot. In fact, you're one of the best shots I've ever seen, man or woman. But you aren't going with me.
Don't you think I have a right to go after the ones who killed me, boy?
I don't deny that.
Then give me one good reason I can't go with you. You've already acknowledged that I'm a good shot.
Yeah, you're a good shot, all right, but we won't be shooting at targets on hay bales. We'll be shooting at men. I don't need anyone with me who might get squeamish about killing someone.
Even if they need killing.
You don't understand. When you're in a situation like this, it doesn't matter whether they need killing or not. You don't have time to analyze the situation. You have to kill, you kill.
Like in a war? In war, people kill people simply because they're on the other side. They don't stop to think whether or not they need killing, or whether they're good men, or whether they have families. They just kill them because it's their job to kill them. I understand that.
Understanding it and being able to do it are two different things.
I can do it.
Francis, look, I know you want revenge for Gordon, and I don't blame you, but there's...
Falcon, when you were at the funeral, did you hear the preacher say Gordon's whole name?
What?
Did you hear the preacher give Gordon's whole name?
Yeah, Gordon Martin.
It was Gordon O'Neill Martin.
I don't know what you're saying.
Me maiden name was O'Neill, and me mother's maiden name was Fitzpatrick. Me whole name was Francis Fitzpatrick O'Neill. You do remember the Phantom of Devil's Den that Mr. Calder was talking about, don't you? The sharpshooter who killed 23 rebel soldiers... Actually, it was only 9. These things always do have a way of getting exaggerated.
How do you know it was 9?
Because it was me. I was the Phantom of Devil's Den.
What? You're saying you were a sharpshooter during the war?
Yes.
That's impossible.
Why? If you read your history, you'll see that there were a lot of women who disguised themselves as men to fight in the war. Even in our Revolutionary War, there was Molly Pitcher. I'm not the only woman ever to do this.
But why in heaven's name would your father let you do such a thing?
My father had no choice in the matter. He was killed at Chancellorsville. My mother died of a broken heart soon after. I had no one left in my family, and I wanted revenge. So you can see this isn't new to me.
Falcon looked deep into the woman's eyes and realized she wasn't lying.
All right. I'll let you come.
You still don't understand, do you, Falcon? There is no letting me come to it. I was going on this hunt with or without you.
Damn, woman. You may just be wildcat enough to come in useful after all.